And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. And a special thank you to John and Kathleen Hogan from hospitalityeducators.com. They were awesome, all about business and the mindset, which is very, very important. Of course, that was the bottom line with Mitch Spean. And now, if it's the first, Frank is shaking there, if it's the first Tuesday of each month, of course, it's the Green Roundtable, starring Eric Kosk, Glenn Gormley, Frank Clemente. How are you guys?
Fabulous. But Glenn is, how you doing, Glenn?
I'm lovely. Just lovely today, Frank.
I know that wig on looks very good.
Oh, yeah.
Wig? What are you talking about?
I'm having a big hair day. That's what's going on.
A big hair day or a bad hair day?
I just call it big.
Oh, there we go. And Eric, how are you?
Bigger's better, right? I'm doing great. How are you doing?
Good. You all look great. Of course, this is a Green Roundtable.
Well, we have a good makeup artist.
Yeah. Who is it?
I don't know. She's a mysterious woman.
Oh, yeah. She sort of comes and
too
goes
bad
here.
It's radio. We need a good voiceover artist.
Yeah, that's that's a good point. Well, let's see. While we're awaiting our guest, and who is our mystery guest, Frank
our
Clemente?
Our mystery guest is Larry Santoyo. He's vice president of Earthflow. And Earthflow, they actually teach permaculture, and they also do projects in different parts of the world. And he has a fascinating experience in a village north of Puebla, Mexico, called Covolv, C-O-V-O-L-V. And he will tell us about his experience there and his insights and what's happening in that part of the world.
Well, that should be exciting.
I would think so.
I know. I first learned about permaculture from you, Mr. Frank, years ago.
Yes.
Remember, we were at Denny's. You invited some guy.
Yes.
And he brings these leaves and plants, and we didn't order. We ate his leaves and plants. And the waitress said, well, do you want some beverage with that? those plants that you're eating?
That's right.
Yeah, that was my first experience.
That's right. That's how we met.
It was sort of funny.
We brought some carrots and a few things, other things.
Well, yeah, this big leaf, I remember, it like fed, you know, like 17 people. I mean, it took like a crane to get it in. So anyway, let's go around the round table. Let's start with Eric. Eric, tell us a little bit how you're doing as well as what you do. Just remind the people, who is Eric Kosk?
Well, I am the owner of Kosk Design and Kosk Design Build. So we're an architecture and construction company. And we specialize in doing green and sustainable design and construction. So that's kind of our big market niche, and we've been doing it for a while. And it's something that really ever since school, when I was I got my undergraduate at University of Illinois, came out to ASU for my master's, and I've always had an underlying sort of interest in sustainability. It was something I did in my thesis, and eventually when I started my own company, I was able to really draw it in and keep going.
That is awesome because, I mean, that's what makes you unique as a builder, an architect. I mean, you really, it's not just that you're in the green movement or thinking or technologies, you really have a passion for it. That's the difference.
Absolutely. And we're always willing to try new things. We've talked about it a little bit before. We're doing a project in Texas right now where, I mean, everything we're doing on it, you know, the walls are made out of dirt. We're trying to eliminate the concrete from the floor. The way we're doing the roof and ventilating, it's just we're literally trying to get rid of everything that you have to bring in from miles away, if not other countries away, to build this thing. You know, we've got a ranch on this particular property. Let's build as much as we can from everything on this particular property, which is a little bit with what Frank was talking about earlier with permaculture and what we're going to get into today. Has some parallels with that. And I think that's really, anytime you can be somewhat self-sustaining, it's a major goal for every project.
So, you know, that's awesome because if you think about it, not only the people, your clients are building a project for them, they're really at a higher level building it for the world. A different carbon footprint, right? They're going to really make a difference.
That is this particular client's goal, absolutely.
So and you get to work with such great people then. Your clients have to be off the charts, incredible, thinking long-term, but thinking with compassion towards the world.
Yeah, and it's the beauty of working with projects that you're working with the owner of the project. I've done a lot of developer projects, and they're great too, but there's something different when the owner is going to take control of the facility, whether it's a commercial project or a residential project. It's theirs. It means a lot more to them, and they invest a lot more into it, too. And it makes it easier for me to invest a lot more of myself in it as well.
That's awesome. What a way to go. That is a great life worth living, having that passion for what you do.
It's great.
And now, Glenn Gormley there with, it looks like a good hair day. I don't really see a bad hair day there, Glenn.
Well, it's like this. I mean, I go out to Sun City, I'm getting all the action, okay? So anyway, no.
Well, what are you doing tonight? Let's go and cruise the Sun City Boulevard. Is that what it's called?
Sunset.
Sunset Boulevard? Yeah, no, that's in Hollywood.
Oh, well.
We call it Holly Weird. But really? So that's a tip for me today, huh?
That's a tip for you. It's not. I'm not struggling in any other area. So if you want to hang in Sun City, you know, go for it. But no, my world's actually great. I mean, I've got a really kind of segue with what
that's the sound of my car, by the way.
What?
You hear it? That's my car. I'm cruising.
Eric, do you really want to know anything about Infinite Green?
Yeah. Okay,
I would
Infinite
love
Green.
To.
All right, Glenn Gormley of Infinite Green. What do we got?
Let's start with passion. You know, again, I mean, I'm the chief cook and bottle washer here at Infinite Green Solutions. And again, like Eric had just mentioned a minute ago, it's about passion. I spent a number of years in another industry where I continued to fill up a big hole in the ground, and that was the garbage business. And today, you know, we've got a new business that is out, you know, talking about reducing carbon footprint and making better choices and reducing costs. And again, we're developing new habits and getting owners involved in employees. So that's why we're pleased, you know, we've introduced a natural line of products that compete with chemicals. And we challenge, you know, those to make decisions whether to clean with a poison or to clean with a much better product.
That's so again, not a poison.
That is not a poison.
Yeah, when you put it in those terms, it makes the decision easy.
Well, you would think it makes the decision easy, but, you know, we must develop new habits to create change. That is the focus of our companies, whether it's on the services side that we may provide for all of our customers, in delivering the products or the products themselves that we sell. So, you know, we work it on both sides of the tracks, and we're finding that our customers are truly interested. And I tell most everybody that I come in contact with, do not underestimate your customer for a minute. They are absolutely taking a look at all different ways of saving money. And if we can save you money and take you green at the same time, we're all about that. So that's a little bit about Infinite Green.
And people want to save money.
Yeah,
that's
everybody.
The
people want to save money. They just do.
Mr. Frank, welcome.
Thank you very much, David. And my part is mostly doing sustainable landscaping, which includes organics and includes using compost and humic acids and things like that. In other words, we start from the ground up, and we build environments that are flourishing, you know, with plants, flowers, herbs, edible flowers, and things like that. So that's fundamentally what I do.
Edible flowers like we had at Denny's. No, I'm kidding. That was my first experience with permaculture. No, Denny's doesn't have permaculture, but the guest we were with did bring, like, trees in and plants, a whole assortment of interesting things. It was actually pretty tasty.
Remember that? If it's grown organically, it would be very tasty.
It would, and healthy, too. So, anyway, let's go right to our guest.
Yes.
Frank, you want to introduce our guest for today?
I would certainly. Larry, are you there?
I am here.
Okay. You've heard our conversation so far.
I
for better or for worse.
I was going to say unfortunately.
Yeah. You can say unfortunately. We're okay with that.
You just said it, Larry.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be the first time.
Yeah.
But anyway, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're doing in San Luis Obispo, and then we can go into Covolve and how that's changing your thinking and maybe creating a new evolution in sustainability and permaculture.
Oh, thanks. I am working in Los Angeles now.
Oh, okay.
Here now, and we've been working on doing some urban permaculture design here in Los Angeles for about 10 years. I think we met a few years ago when that was just getting going. And now we've been doing urban permaculture planning. I'm a planner, a land use planner by training. Mm-hmm. And what I always like to say is that you don't do permaculture, you use permaculture in what you do. So one of the most popular and probably, I would say the sexiest application of permaculture is in landscape design, but there's certainly other applications of it. Permaculture is a connecting system, and we use it for economics, for, economic development, not just in urban areas, but rural areas as well. And that's kind of what led me to this project down in Mexico. I've been working on a book using permaculture for sort of economic development, the economics of sharing and caring. And one of the big things that was missing for me in my personal experience, I'm able to talk from a lot of personal experience in a lot of different realms, but when it came to actually living in a breathing, working, functioning community that used permaculture principles, I was at a loss. So mm-hmm. It was just sort of my conjecture and opinion and argumentation with other people who have tried other types of community. But this, there's a village in Mexico that we'll be working at again here in another month or so. That kind of, I think, has a key to a lot of different parts of what sustainability truly is.
And how, and so were you invited to that community? How did you find it?
Luckily we were invited.
Uh-huh. Okay.
One of the sayings that we've been kind of going off with ever since being trained by Bill Mollison back in the 80s is that we go where we're invited. Uh-huh. And it's part of the respect for sort of cultural aspects of permaculture. In that what I always like to say is that we don't impose a solution, however green or eco-hip it might be, but we arrive at a solution. And one of the things that we've been working with is looking for living examples of some of what we were talking about. And when we found this place it's in the state of Puebla, we really just started taking notes, really learned a great deal about some of the things that have been going on, certainly some of the things that we've been talking about and talking around and talking as if we were the experts, but come to find out that there's been experts living there sort of quietly perfecting their craft for the last 35 years. Sort of an eco-village in every sense of the word. There's a light industry, there's growing, there's food, there's social services. They even have their own banking system.
So tell us about how they nurture industry in that particular community.
Well, my particular interest in what they do is that like ecosystems and a lot of what I teach is systems thinking. Mm-hmm. And we mostly call it that when we're talking to different businesses. I do business consulting, and we kind of arrive at that is a way of permaculture design. But through systems thinking, you look at everything as an ecosystem, that one thing contributes to the next thing so that waste is managed for productivity. So we start looking at natural systems a little more closely, and we realize that everything is supported by a series of byproducts from other things and activities going on in that system.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me.
Yes.
One thing just doesn't run its own thing. There's several byproducts that make it possible. The waste product of one animal might become the nutrient base of another system that, contributes to another and another and another. I think we've all sort of been through that drill theoretically since, seventh grade ecology classes. But the idea is that once they started working together, they realized that they had an incredible skills bank, not just a cultural and ancient skills bank, but literally resources everywhere around them. We'll take one stream for an example, is that they grow coffee, but they don't grow coffee until there's a certain measurable amount of biodiversity that exists in an area, and then they know that planting coffee will be successful because the amount of birds that are there, the amount of other wildlife that's in that area. So it's sort of, again, is the coffee raising the wildlife? Is the wildlife raising the bird or the coffee, and on? Even the waste products from the coffee production and processing is used to grow yet another income-producing resource, which is mushrooms. And then the spent medium that the mushrooms grow, and these edible and medicinal mushrooms that are grown, the spent medium from that is then turned into fertilizer that goes back into some of those fields. So it's quite an interesting, somewhat simple yet incredibly complex when you try to do it in a linear equation.
Eric has a question.
Yeah, Larry, I was just wondering, could you take a step back and give us kind of an overview of this city? You know, is this a coastal city, a mountain city? About, you know, what's the population? How has its maybe talk a little bit about kind of the facts and figures of what it is right now.
Well, right now it's an area just outside of a city called Quetzalan, which was named one of the most beautiful mountain cities to live in.
That's a good start.
It's in Puebla, Mexico, the state of Puebla, which is sort of between Mexico City and the Gulf of Mexico, but it's in the mountains. There is, I would say, 6,000 indigenous people involved in this sort of a cooperative. There is probably 60 or 70 different communities that kind of make up this cooperative, and they all sort of are managed by a general assembly of sorts. It's sort of their own design, and I haven't really seen a lot like it, but it works really well.
So they're able to live harmoniously and share in the productivity, and it also seems like the environment contributes to their well-being.
Well, I think that the short answer is yes. I also think that there's a certain myth to harmony, in that it's not. Oh. It doesn't mean that it's an easy process, or that there isn't conflict, or there isn't, you know, sort of abundance and scarcity. It's a way to deal with those things that I just said.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the natural conditions of abundance and scarcity, and now it's sort of a more global economic system out there. They are looking for outlets and products and different things, but surprisingly, the skill sets that they need to survive exist there, and same with the product. So it's kind of it's a fascinating study for me, especially because, like I said, I'm writing a book, and this was the missing ingredient of what I needed to complete it.
So why do you think this happened to this particular city, and it happened where it did? You know, why aren't we seeing this in more places, or in just other parts of Mexico or similar cultures? What was so unique about this location or this sort of cultural pocket there?
I think that it has a great deal to do with people willing to work together, and I think that happens everywhere. I also work in Los Angeles, I work in Detroit, I work in New York City, I'll be coming to Phoenix here pretty soon. I think that any place where you have conditions that you could call stressors happening, there it gels a certain amount of people and their activity to work towards a unified goal. And I think that in years past, it's just sort of the poverty of Puebla may have led to sort of coordinated efforts of working together. It makes sense in other cultures that we cooperate instead of compete. And it's almost like a default thing, whereas in our culture, we default to competition. In other cultures, it's, you know,
cooperation.
It's not that. It's just not that way. It would be seen as strange or a little bit rude to try to do that.
Well, Larry, it seems like you're also explaining how ecosystems work. They're cooperative.
Well, it's more of a collaborative
effort. Collaborative effort.
Use the resources. You know, that in a natural system, it's hard to say what is the dominant thing because everything contributes to the whole. And I know it sounds like I'm speaking metaphorically, and I actually am, but I'm also speaking literally, where, you know, the waste product of one thing is the resource base of another thing. And it's identical to the way that I would look at a business or economic development in any city. We look for other businesses with waste products that might be our resource base, and that way we save energy, save money, save resources, and create a lower overhead and a higher profit margin.
One of the questions I have is, based on your experience, what would you do different today based on this experience if you were going to establish a permaculture village or community?
Well, I think that is a great question, because where I think I have had challenges before is in trying to establish a community instead of trying to work with what already exists and switch a few of the pieces around. And it makes a huge difference. I used to always want to make a community or to build a community. And now it is incredibly obvious that we already have communities. We just need to rework the ones that we have. And that's really the loud and clear lesson that I've been seeing.
Fascinating.
In a lot of those other areas. I mean, you know, I set people up in my classes and ask who wants to live in a community. And then everybody, you know, and people raise their hands, and I kind of jokingly say, you already live in a community. You know, it's just a matter of repurposing the contributions that each person has in that community. And it's my understanding, and now it's my experience, that just about every small neighborhood has just about every skill set in it to succeed.
How did you stumble upon this place? How did you find it? I mean, it seems like a needle in a haystack.
It is kind of a needle in a haystack. And I was invited with a group of people who are doing a documentary film. And one of the places, they just happened to be interviewing me and interviewing some other people that have been working at this community for some time. We're going to start doing a series of workshops there. And not necessarily trying to help the community, although the byproducts of our participation there will definitely help both economically and educationally some of those communities. But we will be taking so much information, you know, away with us from what we learned there. They've just started doing some outreach through ecological tourism organizations in Mexico. People have Mexico's been getting a pretty bad rap in the Western media, just like most Western media is bad news. You know, there's a lot of good things happening, not just in Mexico, but around the world. And particularly Mexico has suffered a great deal with the reports of violence and keeping people away. And I just want to make sure that people understand that it is, those problems do exist, but they aren't, they don't permeate everyday society. I mean, I think that if you are involved in those kinds of businesses and that kind of activity, then just like in any major city, then you get yourself involved into some trouble. But it's perfectly safe, and it's incredibly beautiful, like it always has been.
Well, Larry, let me ask you a question on this. How this particular community in Mexico, How would you describe their core beliefs and their core values? And because I think that'd be interesting to see the difference between like the core beliefs and core values of like Los Angeles, for example. So I used to live in Los Angeles.
Do we know those?
Yeah. So yeah, I think we do. But describe their core beliefs and core values. I think this is very interesting. That might be the central point.
I could only take sort of my opinion of that. Certainly, by going and talking to some people, you would form your own. But I think that our commonality in each of our understanding of their core values is respect for not just the land, but for each other. And that's kind of a like I said, it's a default that they default to respect for each other first, and then they might, you know, look for other things like that. They say things about how, you know, you can't own the land, but you could, but your responsibility is to steward the land, and we've heard that in all kinds of different ways, and almost like lip service, the sustainability and the eco hipster bullshit, you know, that people talk about, but they're really actually living it, and they're not saying it for dramatic effect, you know, that I might try to pull off, but you know, if they call me on my stuff right away, and you know, it's a different sort of approach to, you know, they're doing it because they're not doing it for points, you know, they're doing it because it's just the right thing to be doing. You know, there's other things to get involved with, certainly there's other crops to be involved with, there's other ways to make money, but they are choosing to train people to be skilled hand crafts people. They're great engineers. They have engineering and construction businesses, as well as it's pretty sophisticated agricultural businesses. And like any small farmer knows, distribution is a huge part of that equation, and they are mastering that as well.
Larry, in order not to give a false impression that that we're looking at Mayan pyramids and people doing sacrifices, what is the architecture like? Just a brief description.
Well, in town, you know, it's from the 1600s, so it reminds me of, you know, any colonial city around the planet. You know, it's that kind of architecture. It looks like France, it looks like Spain, it looks like Italy. And then you get up into the mountains, and they've been building with bamboo for, you know, 800 to 1,000 years in Mexico. So bamboo architecture, you know, those kinds of things are dominant. Oh, as well as stone, and you know, a lot of highland areas like that. But really beautiful bamboo structures, partially underground structures. It's not really in a Mayan area per se. It's more of what was an Aztec area. Sort of it's a Nahuatl, population. Yeah, mm-hmm. These days. It's kind of what the communities are, and the city has an active, you know, farmers markets and different, you know, commercialization that way. And there's hotels and all that. The place where we will be going is there's a really beautiful kind of an eco resort. That's a lot of it's made with bamboo and natural materials and things like that. But gorgeous, gorgeous. You know, it's like out of a storybook.
Well, sign us up. I mean, when we come back from our break, we will continue our discussion with Larry Santoya from Earthflow.
Yes.
Is that permaculture? Very interesting things. I am very interested in the beliefs and the core values like Larry was describing, and we'll be right back.
At Beerenbaum Baum and Spien PC, we want to help you work on your business, not in your business. We take a simple approach. You know your business. Our firm gives you the information to make those decisions better. Our firm takes a proactive approach to your accounting needs, and if you look behind the numbers, you'll find there are hidden opportunities that we try to impart on you. Communication is the key to that understanding, and there is no charge for brief phone calls. Contact us at 602-266-5633 or email us at mitch@jfbpc.com. Birnbaum and Spean works to increase your understanding of your business in order to make the decisions necessary to move your business forward.
What if your house is on fire, you call 911? The firemen don't know what to do, the truck's got a flat tire, the water hose has a leak, they can't decide what to wear, and everybody wants to drive the truck. This never happens because they have a process, they follow it, they're on the same page. I'll help you put your fires out with a business process. I'm Barbara Haggerty, helping you mind your own business. 602-750-4518. Increase the bottom line now. Even a two-person business needs a process, and I specialize in small business. 602-750-4518.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement, offering compromise, or not currently collectible status? Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. This is the Green Roundtable, and starring Eric Koss, Frank Lemeny, and our friend Glenn Gormley had to leave the building early. That must mean someone won a hockey game. Isn't that how that goes?
That's how it goes.
I think so. And we have special guest all the way from Los Angeles, Larry Santoya. Okay, so Larry, let's bring you back to Frank, actually. Frank. You are chomping at the bit to ask some questions.
Yes. If you could talk a little bit about the economics of how they're creating prosperity for the community, and what industries are now in place, and what industries they hope to acquire.
Well, I think that core to all of this is, again, it's kind of like it's a query of the people themselves in the kinds of things that they want, and then it put together with the kinds of things that they have, and then filling in the blanks with the rest of the things they need. So they're focusing on real needs first, and either training themselves, cross-training, or recruiting people to assist them. And what they do is they have a series of meetings, and it's sort of a way that people are heard and a way that people feel like they are being listened to. So a lot of those kinds of things that happen when people don't get that kind of attention. So there's very little sabotaging that goes on in other projects I've been involved with. The people that feel like they haven't been heard, and they'll keep bringing up their own agenda, but that's kind of already taken care of before they embark on any kind of a mission, to solve something. Like I said before, they have there's 66 communities involved in, let's say, 10 or 12 cooperatives that make up an area, and each one of these cooperatives has different production and different contribution to the whole community. So it's almost literally, if we did a graph, it would look like how we would graph out an ecosystem. The kinds of things that they have now, there's a huge push for diversification of farming. They never really fell for the monocrop export-only kind of model. So it's always been about doing a polyculture, and every layer of the polyculture is a different product that supports each other. I mean, like in one farm, they would have cinnamon, black pepper, macadamia nuts, other nuts, a lot of different honey production, different cane sugars, fruits of all kinds, and they all get different processing aspects and combinations. But I think the big thing is mostly the coffee. They've got a coffee co-op and a couple of different processing facilities and a couple different ways that they process coffee. Coffee's processed a couple different ways around the world, and they have kind of perfected their couple of different kinds for their area.
Now, Larry, do you see them primarily as an agricultural community?
I see a more of a social services community that happens to use agriculture and business as their solution to that. That's incredibly peaceful, highly political and social groups of people, but at the same time, incredibly productive. So I think that keeps the cultural richness and creativity, kind of creates the conditions for creativity to happen.
So Larry, one thing that's kind of amazing to me as you talk about all this, it sounds like, you know, cooperatively, or I guess collectively as a community, they're keeping in check in a way what everyone's doing. It doesn't sound like if one agricultural crop or one part of the industry is really turning out to be a bumper crop or a real moneymaker, that, you know, in our society, well, then 200 people would get in line to do the same thing and to start making the big bucks, so to say, in that
right.
industry. And it sounds like that isn't happening here, that they're kind of looking at the bigger picture.
Yeah,
which is really hard to believe, almost, to be honest with you, from an American societal standpoint of view.
Yeah, I think that you may have just hit it, that it wasn't designed by Western
Western thinkers.
By Western thinking, mm-hmm. you know, it was really designed that if in fact there is a bumper crop or a surplus of money or a huge generation of money in one particular aspect, and you have to think of it as dozens of income streams supporting this. So they don't need to make all the money on one thing. That's what a lot of failures do to in our own societies. But so if there is a surplus, then what they do is they use it to strengthen and identify the weaker links in the rest of the system.
Yeah.
And they use it as an opportunity to support some of the other businesses and sort of like everything's almost like a stepping stone for the future.
Now, the other thing that I think about when we talk about this community, it sounds, you know, the poorer a community or a nation may be, it's usually a little more isolated on the global scale. And as we all know, the world's getting smaller and smaller. Corporations are fingering into all parts of the world. How do you see this affecting this particular community over time? It seems like someone's going to try to get in sooner or later because someone's trying to get everywhere and take advantage of resources and a chance to make a buck. How do you think that's going to play out here?
I think that has already started to happen, and it started 30-something years ago, and is why they decided to go this route. You know, there's companies that have been trying to dominate and control all resources, not just Mexico, but most of Latin America, since the 50s. Our U.S. companies have been down scouting and you know, corrupting and, you know, just about every kind of methodology. And it was rejected then. They had the opportunity to participate in that, and they rejected it. And it's been, you know, organic, not because organic is hip, but because it's safe and it's sane and their kids are happier and they can drink their own water. You know,
it's going to be interesting to me as I think the younger generations of communities like this, as they go out to get maybe educated in different parts of the country or the world and come back and experience these different things, how values might change and how that could influence everything that's going on, I think.
Yeah, I think that you've hit another important aspect in that what they did early on was actually encourage exactly that. And they have been pushing their young people out of the nest since they started And most of them return. Most of them actually return with new knowledge that they can bring and spread. I mean, they have embraced the global economy, and this is how they're playing it out.
So another question I had is, so you're here, you're out there sitting in Los Angeles right now. We're sitting here in Phoenix. These could be the two poster child cities for, I guess, anti-permaculture, if you think about it.
Don't forget Detroit.
Yeah, Detroit probably has a glimpse of maybe some sustainability to it. I don't know if you look at the automakers, what they went through, but look at Phoenix here. We're pumping in water from the Colorado River. It's 115 degrees here. You know, you can't go outside in the summertime. You can't grow half the crops. How do you see the things in this town and just in general the things that you're learning about? And, you know, what are the most important, I guess, rules or just ideas to learn from that can be plugged in to modern day urban society and suburban society as well?
Yeah, those are all great questions. And
you're going to tell me to read your book.
Well,
it's in the book.
All right.
The basis.
Actually, Larry, before.
To write a book.
Oh, Larry.
Just that. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Before you answer that, we're going to go to a break and then you can contemplate that question. By the way, Eric, that was an excellent question.
I thought about that one for a while.
Very nicely done. And you're listening to Breakthrough Thinking. This is a Green Roundtable with special, not in studio guests, all the way from Los Angeles. Larry Santoya, Earthflow. Of course, we have Eric Koss in studio with Frank Clemente, and we'll be right back.
What does your landscaping say about you?
I'm friendly to our planet.
I xeriscape.
I'm water smart.
I harvest rainwater from my landscape and garden.
I'm a free thinker.
My landscape is filled with flowers year-round.
I'm energy conscious.
I water wisely.
Clemente Design Landscape represents your vision with an understanding of what a well-designed and cost-effective landscape can do for you. Call us for a free one-hour consultation and evaluation at 602-540-3773. That's 602-540-3773. Or visit the website ClementeDesignIsGreen.com.
Is it important for you to develop a financial plan without the potential conflict associated with commission sales? As a fee-only financial planner, I am paid by you and only you, my client. I'm not compensated in any way by the recommendations I provide. Have you heard the phrase, people do not plan to fail, they fail to plan? My experience has shown that this is too often true when considering one's financial future. If you're ready to take action, call me, Bob Berger, Certified Financial Planner and Certified Divorce Financial Analyst, directly at 602-235-0336. We'll discuss your financial situation and review some small or perhaps large changes that will help you obtain the financial future you desire. Don't let the lack of a plan affect your family's financial future. Call me, Bob Berger, at 602-235-0336 for a free consultation. Again, Bob Berger, Certified Financial Planner, 602-235-0336.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. This is the Green Roundtable every first Tuesday from 3 to 4, starring Eric Koss, Frank Clemente, and Glenn Gormley. This is a great group, and we have a great guest, Larry Santoya, Earthflow. Larry, go ahead and answer that question that our own Eric Koss asked.
Oh.
If we can remember, do they have drive-in movies there, I think was the question.
Do they have latte?
Latte. And mocha.
Yeah, how many Starbucks do they have?
Right. The real interesting thing that I've come to in working with a lot of cities in particular, I live in Los Angeles, I would say the outlying areas, we have about 11 million people, so it's not a small town.
No.
you know, and sometimes I think when driving to Phoenix, it's almost like it's connected. But the idea of living in a huge city has always been, you know, of more and more interest because, as you know, more people are living in cities now than ever before,
right.
And that's sort of the prediction of the future, that we will all live in cities, you know, or majorities of us will. And I think that is really key to learning from places like this place in Quetzalan. And the real simple thing is, when people ask me, how do you make the city of Los Angeles sustainable, or New York City, or Detroit, or Phoenix, you know, the short answer is, and the dramatic answer is, you can't. You can't make, there's nothing in natural systems that would lead you to believe that you could organize that many elements into one working organism. But what we do learn from nature, and what is ironic, is that every person that lives in the city of Los Angeles, the city of New York, the city of Detroit, the city of Phoenix, every one of those people could actually live sustainably. And the way that we would do that is by breaking up into
parts,
incredibly smaller and smaller and smaller pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And it's throughout history has been shown to be successful. You know, Dunbar's number of 150 people, or, you know, we always talk about how it takes 100 people to support 100 people. So we wouldn't coordinate 11 million, you know, people to live harmoniously. What we would do is we would get 100 people and 150 people, and we would duplicate it hundreds of millions of times. Mm-hmm. And it is completely, totally doable.
Sort of like cells,
the human cell,
it duplicates itself.
In permaculture, we talk about patterning
patterning
of the macrocosm, you know, that everything is scalable. And in nature, we look at fractal geometry,
mm-hmm.
where one thing is a repetitive computation that forms a pattern of small successes that are duplicated. So we're really looking at that, you know, at a solution multiplying. So we look at what works, and we multiply it. It's a lesson from nature.
So, Larry, there seems to be an assumption in what you're saying that there's a certain size where you can start a community. And I think you said 100 people. Maybe that was just an example, because 100 is easy to say.
Yeah, right around that. It's an interesting breakdown of, you know, how people organize in disaster, how people organize in different stressful situations, and people organize in prison colonies, and in all kinds of different ways. But there is a number that people sort of resonate with, and if you look at, you know, and nothing is sort of hard fast.
We're
trying to give examples of living, pulsing kind of communities. But if you think about it, and I often do, about what would it take to create a sustainable future? Well, we would need this skill and this skill and this skill and this skill, and then and by the time you get through all of our needs, we're talking about 100 to 150 contributors. Now, of course, that could represent a small group. Each one of those contributors could represent a small group, but I think you understand what I mean.
Right.
And instead of trying to perfect 1 million people or 1,000 people, we just simply break up into smaller groups and do it again. You know, we're doing that with local economics. We have neighborhood time banking, for services and skills. We've got a lot of different micro lending organizations that are springing up all over the place. And just sort of, instead of trying to make a huge institutional sustainability movement, it's really about making things smaller and smaller.
So, Larry, when you look at urban centers on a national or global level, and I have a feeling, well, I'll ask the question first. Do you feel like there's any city that's even remotely on that path? And if so, which ones do you think are?
I think that every city wants to be on that path. I think that, of course, there's corruption. Of course, there's, you know, greed. Of course, but I think that there's a lot of places. The good news is that every city can step into it once they make a decision. I think that, you know, cities like Portland and Seattle are easy, you know, to say. Of course, they've been working on it for 30 years, but I think that in a city like Los Angeles, that once people start making that decision and start, you guys were talking about that earlier too, is that very few people, once they get the information, are going to say, you know, well, let's just do it more expensive and toxic anyway. You know, it doesn't happen that way. You know, if we can save money, save resources, I think that it's just a matter of getting the information out and getting living examples of it. And I think that that's starting to happen in a lot of places. I'm going to be in Phoenix teaching a permaculture course.
What date is that?
I believe that it's 1 weekend a month. It has already started, and phoenixpermaculture.org has more information about that. But I will be in Phoenix in May.
Oh, good. We'll invite you to the show, or you can.
Oh yeah, that would be great. That would be great. And I've got other urban permaculture and village permaculture courses all over the world scheduled for 2011 on my website. You could find more information.
And what is that website?
Earthflow.com/blog/permaculture-courses.
Okay.
There's a list of them. We're going to the South Pacific. We'll be checking on some projects in Haiti. We'll be over in Hawaii. Going to do palm thatching construction in Fiji.
Sign me up for the one in Fiji.
Yeah, I'll take Hawaii.
and we'll be at this village. We're doing a series of courses in April, or people could come down for, you know, 3 to 5 days, or stay for 2 or 3 weeks. That's on my website too. And there's a great video by the documentary filmmakers on Covolve.org that discusses some of the aspects of the trip to Mexico that will be going on.
Well, here's my last question. As far as real estate is concerned, if you were going to choose a condo or an apartment complex or something like that to initiate a permaculture community of, and maybe some that I haven't even mentioned, which one of these would you feel would be most viable?
Well, I think that, of course, everybody has a different interest in where they want to live. But I do believe that eco-urbanism is the future of sustainability. Making our cities more sustainable is how we preserve wilderness. There's a direct relationship to saving resources by making cities more and more sustainable. That said, you know, I've lived a mile behind a locked gate on 660 acres for 10 years, and now I'm in an apartment in Los Angeles. And I kind of like not having to fix fences and chase cattle and, you know, that kind of stuff. But, you know, every player, every piece of the play, you know, needs to be worked on.
Well, Larry Santoya, thank you so much. We're at the end of the show. And contact information, how do they get in touch with you?
People could contact me at earthflow.com. And again, check my blog at earthflow.com/blog/permaculture-courses and get up to date on our next move.
Thank you so much, Larry Santoya from Earthflow. Thank you so much for calling in.
And thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Eric Koss, how do they get in touch with you?
You can reach me at kossdb.com. That's kossdb.com.
And Frank Clementi.
Clementi Design at 602-540-3773.
And call one of us and we'll get you in touch with Infinite Green. I don't know their website. Do you know?
I think it's infinitegreen.com.
Okay, that's easy enough. Yeah, there we go. And that's of course, Glenn Gormley. He had to leave early. But that was a great, very interesting guest. And, of course, next month, don't we have a special guest, Eric?
We have someone from either this old house or this new house. Their publicist is still kind of juggling who it's going to be, but we'll have one of them on here.
Excellent. Well, everyone, stay tuned for that. Of course, next month, first Tuesday, 3 to 4. Everyone have a great week. We'll see you Friday.